Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on Monday. President Obama apologizes for a drone strike that killed two Western hostages held by Al-Qaeda. EU leaders promise more ships and money to combat the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean. And Saudi Arabia resumes airstrikes in Yemen. Here to discuss this week's top international stories on our Friday News Roundup, Christian Carl of Foreign Policy Magazine, Nancy Youssef of The Daily Beast, and James Kitfield of National Journal. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
We welcome our audience as well. You can join our conversation. Call us on our toll-free line, 1-800-433-8850. That'll open up in just a few minutes. You can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or on Twitter. Well, James, a very solemn manner by the president when he came out yesterday to announce that drone strikes had killed an American hostage and an Italian hostage and to apologize for that.
Yeah, well, you know, these drone strikes have been sort of a signature of his counterterrorism policy. You know, he since coming to office, you know, immediately basically quadrupled, I think it was, the number of drone strikes that the previous administration had launched. It's an integral part of his counterterrorism strategy, but, you know, he's also tried to put it on a more sustainable basis, talking about more transparency, talking about higher levels of oversight before you can actually green light a target. And in this case, obviously, it didn't work. We had two Western hostages who were in an Al-Qaeda compound held there, unbeknownst to all the people who were conducting surveillance in that compound. So they launched the strike thinking there were four Al-Qaeda operatives in there, and in their surveillance saw that there were six bodies pulled out. There's a first indication that something had gone really badly wrong.
Well, Nancy, this happened in January. Why did it take so long to hear about it?
We're still trying to figure that out, actually. As James mentioned, their first indications, according to New York Times report, is when there were six bodies instead of four. And then they start hearing intelligence and chatter about Westerners being killed. And then it's interesting, Al-Qaeda didn't acknowledge that Ahmed Farouk, who was one of the Al-Qaeda members killed, they didn't even acknowledge it until April 13th. So it's unclear what was happening, but it was the sense is that the United States was trying to piece together pieces. They'd heard that the American and the Italian had been killed, but hadn't made the link to that January 14th bombing until recently. And so there seems to be an effort to kind of try to piece all that together.
These drone strikes by the CIA in Pakistan are normally kept secret, Christian. In this case, the president decided to declassify some of the information. Why did he do that?
I think he had to do that because there's going to be enormous pressure on him to conduct some kind of formal review to offer some kind of accountability. I found it very striking that when he made his announcement, I mean, James will correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think he ever said we conducted a strike in Pakistan that killed these people and the CIA did it. There are still a lot of complexities about this policy that make it very, very hard to call things by their name. And I think now we're going to see a lot of pressure on the administration to clarify some aspects of this policy.
Why not say the details, James, that it was by the CIA, that it was conducted in Pakistan?
Well, I mean, it's an extremely secret program. There are aspects of how you actually, the chain of evidence that gets you to pulling a trigger on it and launching a missile is something that is very secret. And they're very concerned that, you know, methods and techniques, as they call them, don't get released. So this thing does raise two critical issues, one of which is the signature strikes. This was a signature strike. And that was something that the Obama administration has done and wasn't done before. And that is, you understand from your intelligence gathering that this is an Al-Qaeda compound, but you don't know the identities of these individuals. Now, if you knew the identities of those individuals, you might know that one of those was involved in the taking of this Western hostage. So there's going to be a real look at signature strikes. That's been pretty controversial all along because you don't really know. You have strong evidence that these guys are Al-Qaeda guys, but you don't know their individual identities. And the second thing is, you know, what does it mean when the president says, you know, we have to know with near certainty that there are no civilians in the blast range who are likely to be killed in these attacks. You know, I have been sort of let under a little bit of that when there's, like, for instance, where there's a number of civilians in the compound. At some certain level, you can't launch, and at some lower level, if it's a really high value target, you can. So there's all these sort of intricacies, but I think both those two things will be looked at very closely. And the president has announced there will be a sort of top to bottom review of the program.
In this particular drone strike, did the president himself approve it, Nancy?
He did not. And one of the reasons is it had they known it was an American involved in the case of Ahmed Farouk, that might have been a reason, if for no other reason than legal. I'd love to pick up on what James was saying about the sort of takeaways from this. One of the things that James pointed out was that they'd called this, that they had near certain intelligence on all this, and yet it turned out to be so wrong. In this case, unlike others, it's sort of irrefutable that the circumstances of the case, that this was a mistake made, where in past cases you could argue it. There were some civilians maybe among some fighters, and it was a little unclear. But this is an irrefutable example of sort of the ambiguity with which these drone strikes are conducted. I mean, for example, in Iraq and Syria, there have been 3,500 strikes. And under the official U.S. tally, not one civilian casualty. And so these drone strike wars are so opaque in terms of the consequences of them, in part because, as James mentioned, these signature strikes where one does not have to know exactly who will be hit, and also because there are, in often cases, not ground forces there to sort of reconfirm and figure out the specifics of what happened. And part of that is the fact that we're here in April just figuring out the details of these two January strikes.
Well, one thing that, of course, officials point out, the president pointed out, is that there is collateral damage. There's civilians and innocents who get killed in any kind of warfare. If you're dropping a bomb or you're in hand-to-hand combat or you're having a drone strike. And they argue that the drone strikes are, in fact, have less of that than some of the alternatives. Is that a persuasive argument, do you think?
Well, I think it is a persuasive argument, I'm not sure is quite the terminology I would use. Objectively speaking, based on the very sketchy, one has to say, information that we have, it would seem that the civilian casualties involved in drone strikes are really much lower than, for example, with conventional airstrikes or when you have boots on the ground. On the other hand, these strikes, precisely the point that we're conducting them by remote control, as it were, adds a particular political nuance to the whole thing. I think it's very hard for many Americans to understand just how incredibly controversial and emotional these strikes are in the countries where they take place, in places like Pakistan or in Yemen. These are huge, huge political issues, precisely because there's a perception that the Americans are using their technological advantage to strike from afar with great impunity and with very little accountability and transparency. So, maybe they've kind of got a point, but in a way, that's not the point.
Using your technological superiority to strike from afar with impunity sounds like a pretty good idea to me if I'm a military guy. You're projecting power, you're not projecting vulnerability, as one of these air power guys told me. They are more precise than dropping a bomb from a weapon, or, as someone has pointed out to me, putting a very scared 19-year-old on the street with an M16 and having, and going at it with personnel on the ground. One of the things about these drone platforms is the sensor, i.e. the video, and the weapon are on the same platform. So didn't used to have that. You used to have the sensor be in one place and the weapon someplace else. So the pilot can watch for a very long time. They loiter for 16, 17 hours. So they can see who's gone out of that building in the last 24 hours, who has not. And they can actually, if they see someone suddenly drive up while the weapon is in the air, they can actually steer that weapon away. That's something you can't do with a bomb. So there is a good argument to be made that, these are more precise weapons, but this is war, and there is still fog of war, and the administration is a little bit of the victim of its own success. And, things like near guarantee that there's no collateral damage, that's not possible, really. And these are bombs and missiles you're dropping from the air. There will be civilian casualties.
But I think the complicating factor in this case is that there was an American hostage. And the question becomes, when did they lose track of this hostage? What was the communication going on between the family, between the inner agencies? Because I think all that is true. But that complicating factor of not knowing where an American hostage was, or not making enough sort of putting enough precautions, if you will, in place for the possibility of hitting a hostage, I think is the complicating factor in this case in particular.
Warren Weinstein was the American hostage. Tell us about him.
Well, he was an American aid worker. He was working for USAID. And he had left the private sector, and he developed a love of Pakistan and had gone back, even though it led to long absences from his family. He was taken in Lahore in 2011, and for a while the feeling was that the officials knew where he was. And then in a series of videos that came out during his captivity, he looked more and more worn down. It appeared that he was suffering tremendously. His family, in their statement in which they said they were devastated by his loss, also put the blame on those who held him and not the administration, but at the same time said that they felt that there could have been a better job done by the Pakistanis and the Americans in terms of securing his release.
CNN is now reporting that the family paid a ransom. We'll be pursuing that story. We don't know about that, more about that right now. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Nancy Youssef, James Kitfield, and Christian Carl. We'll talk about what's happening in Europe with that migrant crisis in the Mediterranean and more. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from The Forward, a newspaper and website for Jewish perspectives on news, culture, and opinion. This week, The Forward profiles an African-American surgeon who wants his community to be more like Orthodox Jews. More at forward.com. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with us for the second hour of our Friday News Roundup, Christian Carl of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's also a senior fellow at the Legatum Institute and a senior fellow at the MIT Center for International Studies. He's the author of Strange Rebels, 1979, and The Birth of the 21st Century. We're joined also by Nancy Youssef. She's the senior defense and national security correspondent for The Daily Beast. And James Kitfield, he's a contributing editor at National Journal. He is a senior fellow at the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress. Let's talk about what's happening in Europe. On Wednesday, the EU slapped the Russian energy giant Gazprom with antitrust charges. Christian, what are they accusing this company of doing?
Well, it's very simple. They're accusing Gazprom of abusing its position to, for example, charge different countries different prices depending on how much the Russians like them. Gazprom has actually been accused of a whole range of very complex, one might say discriminatory policies, for the simple reason that Gazprom is not just a company. It is an arm of the Russian state. And the Russian state, the Kremlin, tends to use Gazprom for all kinds of strategic goals. And because of that, it doesn't really operate like a normal bottom-line corporation would. For example, they charge the Poles over four, Poland, over $500 for a regular unit of natural gas. And the very same gas they might sell to the Brits or the Germans for $250 a unit. So this is the kind of thing that the EU has been very concerned about for a long time. They've been thinking about going after Gazprom for quite a while. But the war in Ukraine, the conflict over Ukraine, forced them to kind of stay their hand for a bit when they were trying to get that sorted out. And now it seems the gloves are off.
If they're found guilty, James, what will that mean for Russia?
It will mean fines. You know, it'll mean massive fines. I love this story. This reminds me of this reminds me of Al Capone being arrested on tax evasion. You know, Putin has used the Gazprom, you know, really obviously, as Christian says, as a strategic arm of the Russian government to coerce, to persuade, and it's really pretty outrageous. But the Europeans have sat by and done nothing about it forever. And here's the EU. And one thing the EU can do really well is get into regulations about, you know, what you can and cannot do. And once you get caught in that legal trap, and Putin will fight very hard, and I'll be surprised if they get caught in that. But this is going to make it very difficult for them, because Putin will say this is a Russian state entity, and it will deal only with national governments, because that's in the bilateral relationship. He's able to intimidate people with Gazprom and other strategic tools, such as his military. He's not going to take that off the table very lightly. So this is going to be really fun to watch.
Well, you know, he's got another piece of leverage, which is that Russia now supplies Europe with a third of its natural gas. That, in an era when Russia seems increasingly hostile to the West, that seems like a dangerous situation, Nancy.
Yes, but at the same time, they are also facing economic hardships. So sort of leveraging that in such a way to cut off that supply would be very dangerous for Russia to do at this time because of their own economic hardship at this time. So the sort of obvious option of cutting people off is not necessarily applicable in this case.
You know, we've also seen these horrifying pictures of migrants crossing the Mediterranean and being caught in very dangerous circumstances, a huge death toll. Christian, why has the number of migrants that are trying to make their way to the Italian coast, why has it shot up so much?
Well, I think it's a function of the various conflicts that are going on in the world, not only in places like Syria and Iraq, but also in Africa. I was looking at the photos of some of the migrants getting off these boats in Sicily, and a lot of them were very clearly sub-Saharan Africans. The whole thing has been compounded by the civil war in Libya, by the chaos there, because Libya is kind of a law-free space. And if you want to make money in Libya, it's hard to beat human trafficking because, as we know, the markups for moving people illegally across borders and closer to Europe are, you know, probably surpass the markups you get in the drug trade. It's a very lucrative business.
We saw one boat that in which more than 800 people may have been killed when it sank. James, one other factor has been that there's been a decrease in efforts to rescue them, and that's contributed to the perils that they faced.
Right, and I think this is the moral moment for Europe to look at that policy. I mean, they basically reduced those patrols as a way to send a message to the migrants. So this is a very dangerous thing to do. I mean, we're not going to be out there to rescue you, so don't go. Well, that doesn't get through to someone whose life is so desperate as these guys. So what's happened is you've had these huge death tolls. And even though there's 800 died earlier this week, since that happened, 1,200 have shown up on Italy's shores. So it just shows you this is a mass problem. The European leaders met in Brussels this week. They're going to increase, I think, triple, I saw, the number of maritime patrols, so that's a good thing. They're going to, I think, have a lot more effort in going after these smuggling rings, maybe trying to destroy their boats, etc. They're going to try to reach agreements with governments in North Africa to start trying to, you know, give them money to start policing the problem from their end rather than it gets to the water. But the human rights groups will tell you that you need to have a more humane asylum policy for people who are really fleeing for their lives. But that goes against the sentiment in Europe right now, which is very anti-immigrant. They've had a very rough time economically, and these politicians are not going to easily start having a more lenient immigration policy.
And addressing kind of the root causes for this, for some of these migrants feeling like they must escape whatever the cost, I mean, none of these steps address that.
Well, that's right. And I mean, so to give you a sense, 90% of these ships are leaving from Libya, 90%. And the the irony is that one of the reasons, arguably, that the U.S. and European community intervened in Libya in 2011 was to mitigate the threat of migration happening. I think the context in which this is happening is a huge migration movement happening in the Middle East writ large that is literally fundamentally changing the map. We're talking about 500,000 Libyans in Tunisia, leaving, obviously, Syria, the million mostly Sunnis going into Lebanon. And this is part of this reshaping that's happening that's really overwhelmed Europe in a way financially, politically, and it's changing the map. We talk about these borders being so tenuous, but when you have that kind of migration, it's literally changing the context of the region itself.
Let's go to the phones and let our listeners join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number 1-800-433-8850. You can always shoot us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Let's go to Brownsville, Pennsylvania, and talk to James. James, thank you so much for joining us.
Susan, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, this is directed to all your panel, but it seems like Nancy's the military girl there. What I'm puzzled about is like a Pakistani intelligence gathering people. I mean, we give these people billions of dollars, and this was brought up on the news hour. Remember the kids were killed in that school. They did a surge up in that area where this drone strike. Do we have any assets of Pakistani operatives in the intelligence, or military intelligence? And are they helping us, or is there kind of a chilly relationship between Pakistani intelligence and us? And I'll hang up and listen, and I appreciate your time. Bye-bye.
All right, James, thanks for your call.
Well, both are true, actually. There's intelligence sharing happening, and there's also a frosty relationship. But it's funny that, James, you bring this up because we were talking about this during the break, about what the Pakistanis knew about this compound and who was there. And it's unclear as of yet in terms of what they knew, what they were sharing, and what their interests were in that compound in particular. And so it gets into the very murky relationship between the U.S. and Pakistan and its fight against elements there.
James.
I've referred to that intelligence relationship as the wilderness of mirrors, because it is, you don't know what you're looking at. The Pakistanis have been very helpful. We captured a senior al-Qaeda guy, another one there recently with their help. But they also have ties. Their ISI service has ties to some of these extremist groups. And really untangling that is something over a decade we've been unable to do. So it's unclear. But one thing I will say, Pakistan has started to take seriously its efforts to try to quell and move into these federal, the Fatah areas, the federally administrated tribal areas, because it starts to realize now that these extremist groups are a threat to the Pakistani state. So with the cooperation's better than it was, for instance, around the bin Laden raid, which caused probably a couple of years of frostiness, but it's still a wilderness of mirrors.
Let's go to Susie. She's calling us from Tampa. Susie, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to say on the comment the gentleman made about the casualties of war a while ago, it is war. You cannot afford not to have casualties. No one in the Second World War said, oh, we bombed a town. I'm so sorry. We killed civilians. They said to get the heck out when they could. And I hate that there's war, but people are going to get killed. And I'm sorry for that, but how can you apologize? Two people got killed out of a whole bunch of other people, and I don't want to minimize the two guys that got killed that are on our side. It's war. People die. People get hurt. People have their limbs blown off. It's a shame that we have to have wars, but I think the only way to stop this al-Qaeda and ISIS and all the rest of the absolute insane people over there is to shoot them.
All right, Susie, thanks for your call. Christian.
Well, you know, of course, the caller is right. Civilian casualties are probably, as James is also saying, an inevitable result of any kind of armed conflict. But, you know, to be honest, I'm actually very happy to be from a country that still worries about this issue, that we're actually concerned about it and that we take it seriously, because I think, like the other participants in this panel, have spent a lot of time in countries where they don't and where they just say that, oh, yeah, you know, civilians are going to die, too. That's just what war is. I do think it's important to at least maintain a standard and say, yeah, you know, maybe these things happen, but we are concerned about it, and we're going to try to avoid it to the greatest extent possible. I think that's one of the great virtues of at least in theory, of the, you know, the American military is very, very careful about these things as a general rule, and they don't like to be seen killing civilians. And I think it's good that they do, that they care about it, and I think we should hold them to that standard.
Judy from Ohio sent us an email and asked, "What we've heard the figures for the number of deaths in most conflicts. What are the figures for the victims of the drone strikes, both military and civilian? Are those numbers available, James, the number of people who have been killed?"
There's no reliable numbers. The U.S. government has some very low estimates, you know, less than a couple of hundred of civilians killed in these over the course of, the Obama administration's more than, 6 years. I've seen estimates as high as 2,000, 3,000 from some human rights groups. The problem is the reason you're launching these strikes is you can't get to these people on the ground. You have no presence on the ground. So you can't really do an after-action review, test DNA, see how many people were actually civilians, who was Al-Qaeda. There is really no reliable estimate. Maybe some other of the panels have heard one that they think is really solid. I haven't seen it. On the comment about war, I will say this, and I would like to associate myself with both comments. Yes, these things should cause us to start to look anew at these programs to see if there are things we can do to make it possible that this not happen as many times. But this is war, and there is an opportunity cost if you don't go after these Al-Qaeda leaders. They will do things that will cause lives, too, guaranteed.
Let me just note that Diane has scheduled for first hour on Monday to talk about the drone strikes, the aftermath, the drone program, so you'll want to tune in for that. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Well, in France, authorities announced they had arrested a suspect accused of planning an imminent terror attack. But they got kind of lucky, Christian, in terms of finding this guy.
Well, he seems to have been a bit of a keystone cop. They found out about him because he shot himself in the leg by mistake. And it's tempting to laugh about it and joke about it. But it seems that he may also have been implicated in the murder of a woman beforehand. The police apparently found traces of her blood on his clothing. So as absurd as the whole thing is, it's certainly not a good thing. And the French are definitely very spooked right now. The French prime minister said that they have foiled five other attacks in recent weeks. My understanding was since the Charlie Hebdo massacre a couple of weeks ago. So this is not looking very encouraging for France.
Nancy, tell us about the attack that they think this person had in mind.
So this is a 24-year-old Algerian who, as Christian pointed out, was shot in leg, calls the ambulance, and they find his weapons. And what was, I think, most troubling was that there was evidence that he'd been in communications with Syrians, that there was something that he was taking back from Syria that bring to this attack, and it was intended for a church in the southern suburbs of Paris. And because they were so lucky, I think it was a reminder of the stress that's on the French intelligence and security forces to combat this threat, particularly after Charlie Hebdo, and as they have so many fighters coming back from Syria and potentially bringing skills, orders, target lists. This really sort of punctuated the point, given that there were some suggestions that he was in communications with those in Syria.
James, why does France have such a problem with this?
Because they have the largest Muslim population in Europe of Muslim immigrants. This was Algerians. I mean, it was a former French colony. They have pretty loose immigration and asylum rules for former colonies. So they have a huge Muslim population. It is not assimilated very well. We've said this on previous programs. And now you have, and once you have an unassimilated large Muslim population, and you have nearby, and Syria is fairly nearby to Europe, this civil war that draws Muslim extremists like moths to a flame, this is the foreign fighter problem that we're going to be seeing for years and years and years. Every counterterrorism person I talk to who talks about this foreign fighter program says this is the new normal. You know, you can't track them all. You can't spend 24-hour surveillance on all these people. This guy was arrested when he came back from Syria and held and questioned and told that he was under surveillance, and he still, planned this attack. So there's only so much you can do.
And to a degree, an issue here in this country as well.
Of course.
We talked in the first hour about the arrests in Minnesota this week.
Oh, sure. And that's a new normal here, too. There's hundreds of Americans have gone to fight for ISIS, thousands of Europeans. So, and that conflict is not anywhere near finished. So this, like I said, is looking like the new normal.
Now, Nancy?
I agree. I mean, France has had a particular problem, has had the most fighters go from France to Europe. I think the U.S. has been in a relatively better position in that the Muslim American community here is much more assimilated than it is in Europe. The travel limitations, and also we're starting to see a much more aggressive intelligence effort. Remember, the U.S. has spent a lot more on its intelligence and security than its European counterparts. And so the challenge becomes when you have an allied nation spending less than you are, how you develop the intelligence, because it differs country by country.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about what's happening in Egypt, in Yemen, and elsewhere. Stay with us, and we'll take your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Constant Contact, providing small businesses email marketing to engage customers and connect with new ones. Organizations can use email to send newsletters showcasing their happenings and promotions. More at ConstantContact.com. And from Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom-framed prints and posters. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
On the next Fresh Air, historian David Kurtzer, who just won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Pope and Mussolini, about the troubling alliance between the Catholic Church and the Italian dictator. Kurtzer says while many believe the Church heroically opposed fascism, recently released documents reveal ways the Church supported and lent moral authority to the regime in the 1920s and 30s. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio, James Kitfield from National Journal, Nancy Youssef from The Daily Beast, Christian Carl of Foreign Policy Magazine. Well, Nancy, you spent 2012 to 2014 based in Egypt for McClatchy Newspapers. We've had lots of news out of Egypt. The former Egyptian president, Mohamed Morsi, sentenced to 20 years in prison. What was he charged with?
Well, it's one of the first of four trials, so I imagine we'll start to see more charges like this. In this instance, it was because of the death of about 10 protesters in December 2012 outside his presidential palace when he was president. I was there at the time, and if I remember it correctly, it was in protest to his expansion of judicial and legislative authority to himself. And at the time, it was such a controversial decision that he made, because here was someone who was democratically elected, all of a sudden giving himself power in this group that was increasingly met with suspicion, the Muslim Brotherhood, the party which brought him to power. And the irony is that it was mostly Muslim Brotherhood supporters who were killed in that protest. And so when he was overthrown and arrested in July of 2013. A series of court cases came up before him, and this is the first one and our first sort of hint in terms of how they're going to treat the ousted leader. And so this comes at a time when the Egyptian government is really trying to crack down on dissidents and really sort of return things back to one where the state and the state backers of the state are back in control to try to bring fractures within the Muslim Brotherhood, but stopping short of doing things like charging him with the death penalty, because to do so would be to make him a martyr. And so for Egyptians, I can tell you the charge probably was not as surprising or had as much impact as it did out here, because this has been part of an ongoing pattern of opposition and Islamists being charged under the new regime.
This is the proof that dictators have no sense of irony, because in crushing and in deposing Morsi and in crushing the Muslim Brotherhood protest that came about from that, he killed hundreds, if not more than 1,000. Protesters. Sisi did, the present dictator, military dictator. So he's now, the judicial system in Egypt, and Nancy can correct me if I'm wrong, is not exactly independent here. So he is now charging this guy for 20 years in jail for doing the exact same thing he's done. And oh, by the way, it was the exact same thing that Mubarak was deposed for killing protesters. So apparently killing protesters is all parties in Egypt are okay with that, as long as you're the one in power and meting out the punishment.
You know, James brings up a great point about the judicial system and how it works, and nobody's really quite sure it's independent. Some argue it's not independent, some argue it's too independent, but it often reflects the sentiment of the parties in power. So remember, just a year ago we were talking about Mubarak being charged, and all of a sudden now that his backers are back in power, those charges have been dropped in large cases, as well as those against his sons.
We also saw the mass sentencing recently, Christian, to death of Morsi supporters, members of the Muslim Brotherhood, after a mass trial. What's the state of the Muslim Brotherhood today in Egypt?
Well, it's certainly been hit very hard. Many, many, many of their supporters have been thrown into jail and have received long sentences and worse. But the thing that strikes me about Egypt is that despite this crackdown, despite everything that's happened, I saw one study that said that in the first quarter of this year, there were 1,300 protests in Egypt, right? I mean, it is not a society which has found stability in any sense of the word. There's still a lot going on under the surface. There's a lot of disquiet, a lot of it based on economic issues. And I was very struck by what Nancy was saying about not giving Morsi the death penalty. Somehow, some way, precisely because he's cracked out on the Muslim Brotherhood so hard, Sisi is going to have to find a way to placate the Brotherhood supporters to get them back into Egyptian political life. I'm not sure how you do that after a crackdown like this, but you can't just completely ignore them. They're not going to vanish. Right?
And what are the implications for the United States? James, how does this affect our own interest in Egypt?
Well, it has forced us basically to hold our nose and get back in bed with Sisi, because all of the, I mean, if you remember, Egypt was sort of the epicenter of hope of the Arab Spring. We had the first democratic election, and this is what we have now, a military coup. The guy who was democratically elected is now sentenced to 20 years. So it means, and we have lifted our very temporary embargo of U.S. military weapons to Egypt. We have decided, as we've decided throughout our history in the Middle East, that when it comes to instability versus authoritarian friends over there, we'll back authoritarian friends. And it's what's kept, the Middle East sort of calcified for the last 40 years. But the level of instability is unsustainable in the Middle East right now. So we're back to Libya was a huge mistake. Why did we do that? Because it's worse now than when we went in there and got rid of Gaddafi. Syria is an absolute nightmare. As bad as it was under Assad, it's been a lot worse, with the civil war. In Egypt, we're having to get back in bed with a dictator that makes Mubarak look like a liberal. So it's been a pretty sobering period for our foreign policy. We've had to basically hold our nose and go back to the old ways.
Let's go to the phones and let our listeners join our conversation. We're going to start with Alex, who's calling us from here in Washington, D.C. Alex, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Susan. I had a quick question about the Iran deal and the potential lifting of U.S. sanctions. Iran, through its agents, has killed literally hundreds of Americans, including my father, 32 years ago this last Saturday in the Beirut embassy bombing. Will the terrorism-based U.S. sanctions be lifted as part of the deal?
Alex, we're so sorry to hear about your loss even all these years ago, and we thank your father for his service. Now let's go to the question that he poses.
No, we will not be lifting the terrorism sanctions. We have had sanctions on Iran since 1979, when the Islamic Republic was established, and they took our hostages. They continue to be the number one, as the State Department says, state sponsor of terrorism. And I would just encourage your listeners to understand that this deal is much like the deals we cut with the Soviet Union on arms control during the Cold War, where we never had anything like a normal relationship with the Soviet Union, even though we were talking about arms control. Can you use this deal to segue to have a discussion about Iran's support for terrorism? That would be good, but I don't think anyone's counting on it.
All right, Alex, thank you so much for giving us a call. Well, this week, talking about Iran, Iranian ships were suspected of trying to deliver arms to the Houthi rebels in Yemen, but the U.S. Navy got involved. Nancy, what did we do?
Well, the U.S. sent the USS Thomas Theodore Roosevelt as really sort of a show of the flag, as we saw this flotilla of about nine Iranian ships moving towards Aden, the Yemeni capital, and there were suspicions that they were providing weapons for the Houthis, who are an Iranian-backed force that has really, in the last few months, moved very quickly and aggressively through Yemen, taking several towns. And so Saudi Arabia, a month ago, launched this airstrike campaign against that to protect its own interests, and unfortunately, it wasn't a very well-planned attacked. And so as these Iranian ships started moving in, and in an effort to sort of show force, President Obama said to keep the Gulf open, that the Theodore Roosevelt was being moved in. And as soon as it moved in, the Iranian ships started turning back. Now we'll see if it's permanent. Now, I for one, I'm not convinced that the Houthis needed as many weapons as they've sort of reported this week, because there are so many weapons roaming around in Yemen. And given the eye that is on Iran right now, I'm not sure that they were willing to go to that much risk and that much trouble for something that wasn't that needed. But nonetheless, there was a real escalation, because, you know, the presence of a Theodore Roosevelt against any Iranian ship is likely to intimidate anyone.
Talk about complicated relations, though. We're negotiating with the Iranians. We're trying to get the final details of this nuclear deal done, and trying to keep Congress, administration, trying to keep Congress from blocking it. And yet now we're in this confrontational situation as well, Christian.
Well, it just goes to show you how complicated life can get in foreign policy. Iran is a big player in the region. They have a lot of irons in the fire. They have many different interests. As we were discussing, they support terrorist groups. They support insurgencies. We have many complicated interests. You know, it's certainly fine to try to negotiate with the Iranians on nuclear weapons, but it's very, very, very hard to separate that out from all the other things that are going on. And it's a very complicated relationship. And like James said, you know, no one ever expected that that would mean some kind of across-the-board normality, because these two systems are profoundly different.
If you want to pull that thread a little further, we are supporting, we are fighting the same enemy in Iraq as the Iranian-backed Shia militias. Next door in Syria, they're backing, you know, Assad, who we are totally against. I mean, it is the instability in the Middle East now has gotten so complex that the enemy of my friend is no longer applies. Your enemies are all around, and your friends are pretty elusive.
No, I think there is one part that's quite important for the United States, was Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula has been able to exploit this instability in Yemen. I mean, they control the fifth largest city in Yemen, and Wakala, and that poses, I think, the most immediate danger to the United States. That in this effort to sort of back the Saudis and their efforts to maintain their interests, it may have endangered U.S. interests, in that you have a terrorist organization who's said that they seek to attack the United States, having more fertile ground, more ability to move than they did just a few months ago.
Well, thinking about Saudi Arabia, so on Tuesday, the Saudi-led coalition said it was going to end its campaign of airstrikes. On Wednesday, the bombings resumed. What happened?
Well, they didn't get any of their goals established. So, I mean, they basically want to put the former prime minister back in power. There's no sign that that's about to happen. They said they're going to focus on humanitarian relief, diplomacy, and counterterrorism. Of course, they think the Houthis are all terrorists. So, you know, this ceasefire they announced really didn't amount to much. We are trying to rein Saudi Arabia in and trying to reach. Pakistan leader was in Saudi Arabia in the past week trying to get to a negotiation because, quite honestly, Yemen is one of the poorest countries in the world. The idea that we're bombing infrastructure in the poorest country in the world and creating a one more humanitarian disaster in the Middle East is pretty distasteful to everyone. So, but you know, to Nancy's point about al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, one of the reasons that the Saudis gave was, you know, this is shaping up like so many of the conflicts. It's the Sunni versus Shia. The Houthis are Shia fighting against the Sunnis. The al-Qaeda in Iraq in the Arabian Peninsula is Sunni. The Saudis said, you know, if the Sunni populace has nowhere to go, no champion to help them against the Houthis, they'll turn to al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. So, again, very complicated situation. Lots of terrorists and extremist groups who basically this is very fertile soil for them when there's conflicts like this.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Maybe, Michigan. Ben's calling. Ben, is your town really named Maybe?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Well, I took the call mostly because I like the name of your town. But go ahead with whatever it is you want to ask about.
Thanks. I wanted to question the constitutionality of drone strikes against American citizens. Doesn't it raise questions we don't want to answer when we have an executive branch that can unilaterally declare an American citizen to be an enemy combatant and then kill them? Doesn't that affect due process?
You know, Ben, that's a great question. Of course, this wouldn't involve the accidental killing of the American hostage, but the intentional killings by drones of American citizens. So, James, tell us about the issues that surround those actions.
Well, you know, it is extremely controversial. When the first person they tried to target specifically was Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an American citizen who was the head of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and their chief propagandist, a fluent English speaker and a very dangerous guy. You know, but having the executive branch act as judge, jury, executioner raises huge constitutional issues, which a lot of constitutional lawyers think have not really been addressed. The administration will say that, you know, after 9/11, they got authorization to use military force against al-Qaeda and any associated group, and if Americans join those groups, then they are covered under that authorization for the use of military force that was given by Congress. So that's their rationale.
Ben, thanks for your call. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking a few more calls, 1-800-433-8850. You know, Turkey, actually, we have this issue of the slaughter of Armenians, which the Armenians call a genocide and the Turks do not. Turkey actually recalled its ambassador to Austria just ahead of the 100th anniversary of that massacre. Tell us about this issue that continues to create such strong feelings on both sides, even 100 years later, Nancy.
100 years to the day today, mm-hmm. when Armenians mark this as about 250 Armenian intellectuals were killed and started this mass killing and that arguably killed, if you believe the Turks, 300,000, if you believe the Armenians, 1.5 million, and gave rise to this debate about the use of the term genocide. And so in Austria, the parliament passed a sort of proclamation calling it a genocide. And for Turkey, it is such a sensitive issue, just the use of the term. I mean, to give you a sense of the level of sensitivity, when President Obama made his comments about the 100-year anniversary, he called it an atrocity. And not only that, but he suggested that was the sort of official position where he personally felt something different. In 08, he had called it during the campaign a genocide. But in Austria, they passed this proclamation, led to the immediate recall of the ambassador there, because for Turks, it's just an unacceptable term that this was sort of not a genocide, but a casualty of war. And this comes on the heels of calling back in the Vatican when Pope Francis used the term genocide. And so we're starting to see an increased acknowledgement by the world community that this is a genocide against a Turkey that just rejects the use of the term.
By the standards of independent-minded historians who've looked at this, was it a genocide, James?
Yes, I think that most people would concede that it was a genocide. If something like Rwanda was a genocide, the Armenians were targeted because they were Armenians. There was a concern at the end of World War I that they would be a stalking horse for the other empires as the Ottoman Empire broke up. You know, President Obama has not used the word genocide, but the Turkey's losing this battle. The EU Parliament just passed a sense that this was a genocide. I think the Turks have lost this. I would just, you know, and they are a close ally, and I'm fine with President Obama not uttering the words. It's utterly unimportant to me, you know, with all the problems in the world today, to look back 100 years. But I would just ask our Turkish friends to look what the Germans did after World War II, where they basically tried to put that part of their past class behind them by sort of being very open and discussing it and teaching it in their schools. The Turks have taken a very different approach, and I don't think it's been very helpful for
them. It doesn't look like it's going away either. Well, we just have a moment left, but I want to note that Iran has charged one of our colleagues, Washington Post reporter Jessen Razian, with espionage. Christian, tell us what's happening there.
Well, they arrested him quite a few months ago. There are, I think, now 46 journalists and activists in jail in Iran. He's certainly not the only one, but it is quite unusual for the Iranians to target a Westerner like this. And it's hard to escape the feeling that perhaps he is being used as a pawn in the nuclear negotiations, that hardline elements in the Iranian establishment are trying to hold him as an asset that they can use to make their own, to push their own cause. It's really hard to see this in complete isolation from the other things that are going on between the U.S. and Iran right now.
Jason Razian and the Washington Post deny, of course, they had anything to do with espionage, and our thoughts are certainly with him. Well, I want to thank our panel for being with us this hour. Nancy Youssef from The Daily Beast, James Kitfield from The National Journal, Christian Carl from Foreign Policy Magazine. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be
here.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back on Monday. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.